Hello and welcome to the Weekly Wrap podcast, where we discuss the week's trending news in agriculture and share highlights from the latest Farmers Weekly magazine. My name is Sindhira Chetty, and joining me in studio is Farmers Weekly editor Janine Ryan. Hi, Janine.
Hi, Sindhira. Nice to be in studio with you again.
So let's recap this week's news. Now, research from Wits University suggests that puff adders could actually play an important role in controlling rodent populations, which are a major threat to crops across the continent. They are calling them friends of farmers. Most snakes are venomous.
Well, puff adders certainly are. Mm-hmm. So it's quite amusing to me that the study particularly sort of touts puff adders as the solution to farmers' rodents problems, because mm-hmm. Puff adders are obviously very venomous. I don't think they're on the world's top 10 list of venomous snakes, but if you get bitten by a puff adder, you definitely need some medical attention. And with our shortage of anti-venom in South Africa, I'm not sure how many puff adders you want slithering around on your farm. The same study also mentions, though, mole snakes and brown house snakes as rodent eaters. So mm-hmm. I think my advice for farmers and even homeowners would be rather try to attract those species of snakes to your farm rather than puff adders. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, not only do you risk being bitten or having family members bitten if you have like a large population of puff adders on your farm, but they're also a risk to livestock. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm not so sure about the friends of farmers thing.
It's quite a big threat to your livestock if they're roaming around the farm.
Yeah,
but I guess in this instance, they're probably referring to crop farmers.
Yeah, but I mean, any animal that you have on the farm could potentially be at risk. It's quite interesting, though. When I used to stable my horse in Lanseria, there was a puff adder once there that they discovered behind a shed. But it was interesting because apparently around horses, this is what I've heard. I don't know if this is actually true, but the snakes tend to stay away because of the vibrations of the hooves on the ground.
That's
so it's almost like a warning sign to the snakes to stay away. So who knows? I don't know if that's true, but it's interesting.
In this case, it's all about research and what they've discovered. We just have to probably speak to farmers and find out their views on whether they would actually have these snakes on their farm.
Yeah, it'd be an interesting survey, actually. We should do something on social media.
The next article is the containment of foot and mouth disease in South Africa, which is an ongoing challenge, but it seems that significant progress is being made. Recently, Minister of Agriculture John Steenhuisen announced that intensified efforts by the department are yielding results. Disease management areas in the Eastern Cape and Limpopo will soon be lifted, and it seems that an urgent order for vaccines worth 72 million rand has been placed. Now, Janine, this marks a positive step in the fight against FMD.
Yeah, so I think as most listeners would be aware, we've had a number of issues with FMD over the years. It is endemic to Southern Africa, so it's unlikely that we'll probably ever get to a state of complete disease-free status, although I think we have been there in the past, so maybe it is possible. But yeah, as far as government intervention has gone thus far, I think they're doing a pretty good job at trying to contain the spread of FMD. I don't really know what else they could be doing. It's impossible. It would be an impossible task for government to individually monitor each and every farm mm-hmm. to ensure that they're following biosecurity protocols and so forth. So, yeah.
Well, government also mentioned that biosecurity should be every farmer's responsibility. They can't be everywhere, so farmers should take that upon themselves to make sure that their cattle are checked and they are adhering to these strict control measures.
Yeah, I think a lot of the sort of active cases that we have now are a result of animals being moved in areas that they shouldn't have been moved. Animals being sold when they're already symptomatic. So, you know, it's obvious that the animal's sick and they're still being sold off at auction. So farmers will have to take greater responsibility for their own livestock, because FMD remains a threat to the national herd. It's not just your cattle, it's everyone's cattle. And not just cattle, even other livestock as well. I recall a few weeks ago we had that story about the RMIS biosecurity marshals.
Yes.
So I don't know what's happening with that, but I think that would be an important next step in terms of enforcing some sort of stricter, overall biosecurity.
Or stricter measures.
And ensuring that farmers actually adhere to those biosecurity measures.
Okay. So earlier in May, South Africa witnessed what's been called a vulture genocide after two mass poisoning incidents in the Lowveld, where 300 vultures were poisoned. Now, these attacks appear to be deliberate, aimed at preventing vultures from revealing poaching activity. Now, Janine, given the scale and the seemingly deliberate nature of these vulture poisonings, what does this tell us about the evolving tactics of these poachers?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, poachers are sort of unscrupulous in their activity. So it's not just the animals that are being poached that are being killed. It's also surrounding wildlife, like vultures in this instance. So obviously they poison the vultures because the vultures alert rangers to carcasses, so animals that have been killed. And you know, the sooner those carcasses are discovered, the easier it becomes to potentially capture the poachers. So if the trail goes cold, then it's harder for those poachers to be held accountable, to be found or identified or whatever. And it's particularly sad because these vultures, a lot of them are endangered. You know, there's only a few of them left in wildlife as it is. And I'm not really sure what the solution is ultimately. Because you can't contain vultures. They're birds, obviously, so they fly. So you can't put them in a pen or something.
Mm-hmm. You can't confine them in a small space.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I know we put birds in cages, but obviously that's not going to...
These are vultures.
Yeah, it's not going to work in this instance. So I think at some point we'll have to do a follow-up story just to see what measures are being taken to actually prevent this from happening again in future. But I think this is like the second or third time this has happened in the recent past.
Now, let's move on to the latest issue, which is the 6th June issue. This time, the focus is on potatoes. We know that potatoes is such a versatile crop. And personally, I love potatoes in a spicy curry or even as chips. But beyond the kitchen, there's a lot to unpack about their role in agriculture. So the first article is an insightful interview with Willy Jacobs. He is the CEO of Potatoes SA. He talks about how the decline of the municipal fresh produce markets is affecting the industry and potato farmers. He also talks about how produce is traded in the market and the support structures for farmers.
Yeah, so I think in the last podcast we spoke about the fresh produce market. And while our system is a particularly good one, I think it's probably the best fresh produce trade system in the world. But the markets have fallen under serious decay over the years, which is very, very sad. And I think for potato farmers in particular, it's problematic. One of the reasons for this is that the produce is left on the market floor for so long that the quality of the produce begins to suffer. And then obviously that affects the overall price that a farmer will get for his produce. And with profit margins being as tight as they are, farmers can't really afford to receive a lot less for their produce than they sort of hope they would get or expected to get. Yeah, and I think potatoes are quite finicky, or particularly quite finicky. So proper storage is very important, and it's just overall bad for fresh produce in general. But I think the potato farmers are definitely suffering quite a bit at the moment in terms of the situation at the fresh produce markets. Of course, there is also direct selling, which I think Vinny touches on. Which is perhaps something that farmers could consider.
But he also mentioned that farmers are doing direct sales, but the pricing is based off what is being sold at the markets.
Yeah, so that's also problematic because even if you are then direct selling, you still might only get a small amount for your potatoes or a lot less for your potatoes than you sort of initially budgeted for. And so while the price of potatoes may be going down, we also then see a drop in quality, which is bad for the industry overall, because, you know, as a consumer, if I keep on buying potatoes that are of poor quality, you know, how long are you still going to be buying potatoes for?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all sort of counting our pennies these days. So people, when they spend money, they want to know that they're spending money on quality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sad because the quality is not reflecting the potato farmers, what they've actually produced. It's not reflecting the good quality that they've produced. It's because of these issues at the market that this is happening.
Well, Willy also talks about the potato industry in the next 5 to 10 years. Let's maybe talk about that as well.
Yeah, so he talks about consumer trends over the next few years. And I think he talks specifically about convenience foods. So something like potato chips or crisps, I guess, are considered convenience foods. And the more people buy convenience foods, obviously, the more demand there is for them. So I think potato consumption in that regard overall is on the up. I think we'll see an uptick over the next few years, which is good news for potato farmers. So, I mean, ultimately, if you sell your potatoes either for processing or for sort of selling on the fresh produce market, as long as you can sell them, you'll make some money off of it, which is obviously the ultimate goal.
But I think for Potatoes SA, what they also wanted to do is educate consumers about potatoes.
You know, I mean, I, like you, love potatoes. It's such a versatile carbohydrate. You can do anything with it. You know, you can mash it, you can boil it, you can roast it, you can turn it into chips, you can put in stews and curries and soups or whatever you want. It's a really wonderful crop. So I think if people learn about the wonders of the potato, there'll be more of a demand for it.
Okay, so the next article is actually our main cover article, which features potato farmer Franlin Rousseau. And it's a great story for farmers facing transitions or tough decisions, and shows how thoughtful management can actually keep a business more productive.
Yeah, so Franlin, she's not just a potato farmer, she also produces other crops.
Yes,
so she's
yes.
a sort of a mixed farming component. And she took over the farm, or the management of the farm, after her husband passed away. And either slightly before him or slightly after him, her father also passed away. So she was left with this big responsibility of looking after this business. And really, it was a sort of baptism by fire, because she was sort of thrown in the deep end and had to learn how to swim very quickly. So she's a very inspirational woman who's really done remarkably well, considering, you know, the difficult circumstances under which she started.
Also, when I was reading through the article, she mentioned that during this transition, she had to learn quite quickly. And then she mentioned how she downscaled production just to farm better for herself. And she said that she had two contracts or two suppliers, and she had to cancel one because it wasn't feasible for her. She knew her limits. And I think that's what farmers can actually take from her. There's a lot of lessons to be learned.
Yeah, I think many farmers get stuck with this idea that you have to produce a certain amount of, well, potatoes in this instance, or certain amount of animals, or whatever it may be, to be successful. But that's, you know, that's not the case at all. And, you know, you need to know your limitations.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in cases of drought, for example, if it's not feasible to keep a herd of 200, you know, it may make sense to cull half your herd if that's what needs to happen in order for you to get back onto your feet and to actually be productive. But, you know, the Franlin's story, or the article you wrote about Franlin, is a sort of typical production story, in that we talk about how she goes about producing potatoes. But the most interesting parts for me, or the highlights at least in the article, was her use of technology to do some of the work for her. So in this case, particularly aerial spraying, and the use of drones to spray.
She did mention that she tried planes and helicopters, but the use of drones worked better for her.
Yeah, it's closer to the crop. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot more targeted spraying mm-hmm. on the crop. You know, if the higher you are, obviously the more sort of dispersion of droplets and whatever there is. So I think she used planes, she used helicopters, and now she's using drones.
Mm-hmm.
And it also helps in particular with soil compaction, which is obviously a big issue for a lot of farmers because, you know, the more compacted your soil is, the harder it is for crops to grow. So by using drones, you sort of eliminate that part of mm-hmm. people having to sort of trudge or machinery having to trudge over the soil and compacting it. And then another highlight in the article for me was when she harvests, she uses some mechanical means to harvest, but then she still also uses manual labor.
Mm-hmm.
And this was interesting because she says while she could mechanize the entire process of harvesting, she sort of recognizes her responsibility to the community to employ people to do the job of mm-hmm. harvesting. And I think that's a very nice sentiment, really, is that you know, this is someone who's passionate about farming, but who's also passionate about her staff and her community, mm-hmm. and she tries to help where she can. She recognizes the need for jobs in her community and also how farming actually aids in mm-hmm. providing livelihoods for many people.
So the next article is our Breed of the Month feature. June is Beefmaster Cattle. It's a hardy beef breed, and Tony Brink imported the first Beefmaster semen in 1970, and it was officially accepted by the SA Stud Book in 1987. So let's talk more about our Breed of the Month.
Yeah, so as you said, Beefmaster is part of our Breed of the Month segment for June, as we've done before with the Bonsmara and the Limousine. And then last month we had the spotlight on horses, looking at various horse breeds. So for June, we're focusing on the Beefmaster, and then for July, we'll focus on the Boron. But we'll obviously speak about that in July, mm-hmm. a little as we get on in the year. So the first article that we've done on Beefmaster looks at the history of the Beefmaster. The breed is a composite breed, so it's not a sort of, how can you say, an inverted commas natural breed. It consists or has been made up of, I think, three different breeds.
Yeah, it was Shorthorn, I think Hereford and the Brahman.
Yeah, and it was developed by Tom Lasseter and his father before him in the US mm-hmm. in the sort of early to mid 1900s. And I think what made Lasseter sort of stand out perhaps from other breeders is his six essential philosophy, which says that you only select for these six essential profitable traits. So he says those are fertility, weight, conformation, milk production, hardiness, and temperament. And so anything that doesn't adhere strictly to those profitable traits, you don't breed with, or they're culled, they're removed from the herd. And then, of course, he called the Beefmaster, because he viewed it as a sort of superior beef cattle breed. I stand to be corrected, but I think it's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, breed in America and the US, which is obviously big beef cattle mm-hmm. production going on there. And there's also many, many breeders in South Africa and registered cattle. So it's a very significant breed, and they are quite docile animals.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I've walked amongst Beefmasters and haven't felt like, you know, you might die, like your life doesn't flash before your eyes.
All right, thanks, Janine. And that's it from us this week. Thank you guys for listening in. The latest issue of Farmers Weekly is available at your local shops. You can read it online via Magsta and Zinio. And don't forget to subscribe, share, and let us know what you want to hear more of. Until next time, happy farming.